Today is February the 10th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is also available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. Your iPhone's adult content filter blocks anything Asian. Enabling Apple's Limit Adult Websites filter in the iOS screen time setting will block users from seeing any Google search results for Asian, that's A-S-I-A-N, in any browser on their iPhone. The content filtering feature is designed for parents to control what their children see when they browse the web. But the terms that are being blocked seems arbitrary at best, and in the case of the Asian exclusion, insulting. The search results exclusion was initially reported by The Independent, but Gizmodo was also able to independently confirm that enabling the filter means any search tangentially related to Asian, that is to say, Asian American, Asian food, Southeast Asian, Asian restaurants, will return a message reading, "You cannot browse this page at google.com because it is restricted," or the URL was blocked by a content filter. The issue was first spotted by Stephen Chen, an iOS developer on Twitter. Chen also told The Independent that he had filed a report to Apple in December of 2019 pointing out the issue, but he never received a response. Gizmodo reached out to Apple for comment, but also didn't immediately receive a response. Right now, it's not clear how Apple decides which search terms are adult and which ones aren't. It's very possible that this is an error from some artificial intelligence program that just scrapes search results for popular porn terms. But at the same time, something like this should not be left to artificial intelligence. The alternative is that a group of humans did oversee and approve this list of terms, which would be just terrible that they did this. Regardless of whether this was or wasn't an intentional decision, the fact that this had been reported to Apple more than a year ago and still nothing has changed is very disappointing. It is disappointing that a neutral term like Asian, which on its own is not pornographic, has been labeled an adult descriptor, appears to be the only racial term that's singled out in Apple's adult content filter, is very disheartening. There are plenty of reasons why you would use the word Asian in a Google search. You could be making travel plans, finding places to eat, recipes, geography, or other innocent terminology that you want to use with the word Asian. But personally, the worst thing is that if any child wants to look up Asian history, it's considered restricted content. I guess it's called culture cancellation. Well, call me Neanderthal. This was just posted on the Google website from the Director of Health Technologies by Shwetak Patel. I'll read it to you, and I have to follow up on this. Mobile devices have become essential daily tools for people all over the world, from staying connected to taking pictures and accessing information. Thanks to the sensors that are already built into smartphones, like your microphone, camera, and accelerometer, these devices can also be helpful for daily health and wellness. Heart rate and respiratory rate are two vital signs commonly used to access your health and wellness. Starting next month, Google Fit will allow you to measure your heart rate and respiratory rate using just your phone's camera. These features will be available in the Google Fit app for Pixel phones, with plans to expand to more Android devices. Measure and monitor respiratory rate directly in the Google app Fit. To measure your respiratory rate, you just need to place your head and upper torso in view of your phone's front-facing camera and breathe normally. To measure your heart rate, simply place your finger on the rear-facing camera lens. While these measurements aren't meant for medical diagnosis or to evaluate medical conditions, we hope they can be useful for people using the Google Fit app to track and improve day-to-day wellness. Once the measurements are made, you can choose to save them in the app to monitor trends over time, alongside other health and wellness information. This was developed to work for more people in real-world conditions. Thanks to increasingly powerful sensors and advances in computer vision, these features let you use your smartphone's camera to track tiny physical signals at the pixel level, like chest movements, to measure your respiratory rate, and subtle changes in the color of your fingers for your heart rate. We developed both features and completed initial clinical studies to validate them, so they work in a variety of real-world conditions for as many people as possible. For example, since our heart rate algorithm relies on approximating blood flow from color changes in someone's fingertip, it has to account for factors such as lighting, skin tone, age, and more in order to work for everyone. With continued advances in hardware and software, sometimes that device that could be most helpful to your health and wellness is already in your pocket. Our team of researchers and clinicians are exploring how everyday devices and inexpensive sensors can give people the information and insights they need to take control of their health. You can learn more about our work in this area by turning into the Checkup, a virtual event showcasing how Google is working to tackle some of the biggest challenges in health. Most fascinating posting by Google. We'll follow up next week with more information. Comcast changes data usage rates, but has since suspended action for Northeast customers. Comcast initially announced in November that it would impose the new regional data restrictions in Pennsylvania and other service areas, including the District of Columbia, New York, Virginia, and Maryland. Similar rules and fees already cover Comcast customers in other parts of the country. There were complaints from several customers about a Comcast Xfinity notice, which said in part, "As part of this new data usage plan, you'll be charged $10 plus tax up to a maximum of $100 per month for each additional 50 gigabytes of data usage over 1.2 terabytes in a month." Comcast said 1.2 terabytes is a massive amount of data, and the vast majority of customers would never come close to hitting it watching movies. Stating that the average household, with two people working from home plus kids in virtual school and nighttime streaming, will use about 500 gigabytes a month. Listen, when they're home, they're not watching movies. Many consumers are still outraged over this. Customer Reports tech editor Jim Wilcox said, "It's become an annual thing for companies to raise prices on TV and internet service." The good news is the Comcast rollout of the new data threshold has been delayed, while emails sent to customers in the Northeast region indicated bills could be impacted as early as March, but now there will be no change until at least August. The cable giant said it would postpone the new charges after Pennsylvania's Attorney General raised concerns that Comcast policy threatened to disproportionately harm cash-strapped Americans. Last week, Comcast said it would suspend its new fees on heavy home internet users in more than a dozen northeastern states, reversing course on a policy that threatened higher bills for some families amid the coronavirus pandemic. The changes do not affect Comcast customers in other regions. The company previously announced a suspension in Massachusetts after state lawmakers introduced legislation that sought to take aim at the new fees. The extra fees would have applied only to the heaviest internet users, those who use more than 1.2 terabytes of data each month. Under a deal brokered with the Pennsylvania Attorney General, Comcast pledged to be more transparent about its pricing and take additional steps that include waiving some fees for customers who canceled their cable and internet contracts early. Comcast suspended its new data charges until July, so consumers will not see any fees until their August bills, according to the Attorney General's office. But cable subscribers should be aware, broadcast TVs are going up by as much as $4.50 a month, and there's a $2 bump to get regional sports networks, says Consumers Report. For those who are frustrated by these price hikes, you can always contact your internet or cable provider to see if there's a way to lower your bill. This is not only Comcast, but if you feel that you have a very high internet bill with other cable companies, look at your bills and learn how you're using your cable and data. One bright spot for consumers is a new law now in effect that requires cable and satellite TV companies to disclose the total monthly price of your bill. That includes all charges, fees, and estimated taxes. The law also bans those companies from charging you rental fees for equipment like a router that you provide itself. The heightened scrutiny facing Comcast reflects regulators' recent efforts to combat the country's long-standing digital divide between those who can access and afford reliable connectivity and those who cannot. These digital inequities predate the pandemic, but have become more consequential at a time when Americans have little choice but to stay home. Last spring, the Federal Communications Commission brokered an agreement with AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, and other major telecom companies to suspend shutoffs and other steps to ensure that people who lost their jobs during the worst economic crisis in a generation also did not lose their ability to access the web. The agreement expired in the summer, but the companies say they have kept in place some policies to help customers who fell behind on their bills. Comcast said it would boost minimum speeds for Americans who subscribe to Internet Essentials, the company's low-income broadband offering. Comcast will also forego data caps imposed on customers in the program. When your bill comes in each month, check it, and you may be able to cut a few dollars out. Microsoft makes available Windows 10 in cloud configuration setting for IT administrators. Microsoft is continuing to try to simplify the management of Windows 10 PCs for businesses and education customers, this time with a new collection of settings called InCloud. Microsoft is making available a recommended set of configuration settings to IT pros who want to set up Windows 10 devices in a cloud-first way, called Windows 10 InCloud configuration. These settings apply to Windows 10, Microsoft Endpoint Manager, and a subset of Windows apps. Microsoft made details about cloud config available via a new website and documentation just last week. Cloud config is not a new version, edition, or mode of Windows. Officials stress it is a set of settings that can be applied to existing PCs running Windows 10 Pro, Windows 10 Enterprise, or Windows 10 Education, and is deployed using Microsoft Endpoint Manager. What's left out is Microsoft Windows 10 Home Edition. Microsoft is targeting Windows 10 Cloud Config at businesses and educational institutions. Microsoft's frequently asked question area of its site described Cloud Config as a Microsoft-recommended device configuration for Windows 10, cloud-optimized for users with specific workflow needs. Cloud Config is for groups of users with simplified needs like productivity and browsing. The ideal candidates for this would have no dependency on on-premise infrastructure, use Windows 10 devices that don't require a lot of complex settings, custom agents, and the like, and use a focused set of apps, including a couple of internal line-of-business apps, in addition to Microsoft's own Office-related apps. Devices would be configured with a default Windows 10 security baseline and receive automatic updates through Windows Update for Business. Via Cloud Config, users are enrolled with Azure Active Directory set up using Intune Endpoint Manager and receive an IT-curated set of apps, including the new Microsoft Edge, Teams, OneDrive, and, optionally, Microsoft 365 apps. Microsoft is calling out frontline workers, remote workers, and education users as good potential candidates for Windows 10 Cloud Config. As a number of Microsoft watchers have noted, Microsoft needs a simpler, streamlined way to manage PCs, especially in education, if it intends to go head-to-head with Chrome OS and Chromebooks. Given that the first Windows 10X PCs should hit the market in the coming months, and the rollout of Microsoft Cloud's PCs visualization service is believed to be imminent, it's a good time for Microsoft to try yet again to get a handle on improving and streamlining Windows 10 PC management. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign announced that it will discontinue its use of remote proctoring software Proctorio after its summer session ends this year. The decision follows almost a year of outcry over the service. Both University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's campus and around the United States citing concerns with privacy, discrimination, and accessibility. Proctorio is one of the most prominent software platforms that colleges and universities use to watch for cheating on remote tests. It uses what its website describes as machine learning and advanced facial detection technologies to record students through their webcams while they work on their exams and monitor the position of their heads. The software flags suspicious signs to professors who can review its recordings. The platform also enables professors to track the website students' visits during their exams and bar them from functions like copy and pasting and printing. Though Proctorio and similar services have been around for years, their use exploded early last year when COVID-19 drove schools around the United States to move a bulk of their instructions online. So too has scrutiny towards their practices. Students and instructors at universities around the country have spoken out against the widespread use of the software, claiming that it causes unnecessary anxiety, violates privacy, and has the potential to discriminate against marginalized students. In an email to instructors, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign wrote that professors who continue to use Proctorio through the summer of this year's term are expected to accommodate students that raise accessibility issues, and that the campus is investigating a longer-term remote proctoring solution. The service was never considered to be a long-term campus proctoring solution. Proctorio has been controversial on the campus since the service was introduced last spring, and concerned students only grew more vocal through the fall of last year. Over 1,000 people signed a petition calling on the university to stop using the service. Proctorio is not only inefficient, it's also unsafe and a complete violation of a student's privacy, according to the petition. University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign is one of the many campuses where remote proctoring has faced backlash. A Miami University petition, which gathered over 500 signatures, declared that Proctorio design invades students' rights, is inherently discriminatory, and is inconsistent with peer-reviewed research. Over 3,500 signatories have called on the University of Regina its use of ProctorTrack, another automated proctoring service. A 1,200-signature petition urges the University of Central Florida to dump HonorLock, which is another similar software, declaring that students should not be forced to sign away their privacy and rights in order to take a test. Professors and staff have criticized the service as well. The Electronic Privacy Information Center filed a complaint against Proctorio alongside four other test proctoring services, claiming that the service's collection of personal information amounts to unfair and deceptive trade practices. Even U.S. senators have gotten involved. A coalition including Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, and Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey sent an open letter to Proctorio and two similar services in December, citing a number of concerns about their business practices. The complaints largely revolve around security and privacy. Proctorio's recordings give instructors and the service access to some of test takers' browsing data and a glimpse of their private homes in some cases. Proctorio stated in its response to the senator's letter that test takers' data is secured and processed through a multiple layer of encryption, and that Proctorios retains its recordings for the minimum amount of time required by either our customer or by applicable law. Accessibility is another common concern. Students have reported not having access to a webcam at home or enough bandwidth to accommodate the service. One test taker said she had to take her first chemistry test in a Starbucks parking lot last summer. Students have also reported that services like Proctorio have difficulty identifying test takers with darker skin tones and may disproportionately flag students with certain disabilities. Research has found that even the best facial recognition algorithm make more errors in identifying black faces than they do identifying white ones. Proctorio stating in its response that they believe that these cases were due to issues relating to lighting, webcam position, or webcam quality, not race. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, citing student complaints relating to accessibility, privacy, data security, and equity as factors in its decisions. It recommends that students for whom Proctorio represents a barrier to test-taking make alternative arrangements, as the program is phased out and indicates that accessibility will be considered in the selection of the next remote proctoring solution. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign Associate Chancellor said, "We had to secure a short-duration license for Proctorio usage in March of 2020 under an emergency procurement action permitted by the state of Illinois in direct response to COVID. We sent a message notifying instructors that they will not have it as a tool beyond the duration of the short-term procurement. We are investigating remote proctoring tools for longer-term usage." I got a better solution. According to the CDC, they are extremely low risk. Why not get them back into the classroom? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Shadow IT Downsides and Concerns.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now we'll get down to business. We'll start talking about some of the things that happen in the IT world. Now, a week ago, I was talking about Shadow IT. The idea of Shadow IT is where you bring your own technology, you bring your own hardware, software, services, whatever it is, and you bring them into the company to help you do your job better. Or at least you think it's better. The company may have their own ideas as to what is allowed and what is not allowed, what is better and what is not better, what is more efficient and what creates a nightmare for IT. There are a number of things that fall into this category. Now, last week I did say, look, it happens. Shadow IT comes along and it becomes official IT over the course of however long it takes for it to be adopted by the powers that be. Now, there are things that raise concerns along the way. Shadow IT can be very, very good for the company as people start thinking outside of the box. It can also be very bad. For instance, let's say that you go and you decide you're not going to use the company network to save your files. You're going to start using Dropbox. How does the company know that you're not sharing files intentionally or unintentionally with somebody else? How do they know that your Dropbox account hasn't been accessed by the competition or by somebody else? And the answer is, they don't know. They have no control over it because it's your own personal Dropbox. Now, you can say, I'm only using Dropbox because I know it's faster for me to move files between my computer and my boss's computer. And that's something that happened with Dropbox originally and a number of these other file sharing services where, yes, people came along and they started using these various systems and files got moved around and people became more communicative with their various coworkers and peers and managers and whatnot. However, it's frustrated IT to no end. So actually, within the IT world, a number of different approaches have been made to kind of duplicate that same level of service. Same thing over in the chat world. There are so many different chat softwares out there. I'm thinking of Skype for Business, but Skype for Business is also equally represented by software like Slack or even WhatsApp or even, the list goes on and on. So what happens here? What happens when we have a situation like this? We can't control, we as IT cannot control who you're sharing information with. Now, I come from one of the companies I worked for a number of years was an aerospace subcontractor with contracts with basically military implications. We couldn't allow things like that. If somebody was using any of these services that were outside of my control or IT control, that was a potential military level violation. So we have to be very concerned about this. We have to be very aware of the potential for abuse, the potential for people getting access that shouldn't get access. But here's another one. Here's another one that concerns the higher-ups in IT. What happens if you bring your own mobile phone and you start utilizing that mobile phone for business? Now, there are features when you connect up to certain mail servers that say, okay, you want to use our mail server, you're going to give us permission to access your phone and remove all of that data if you leave the company. Well, how do we remove that data? One of the ways is to nuke your phone from space. All right, it's a fun term we use, but it does really mean kind of what you think it means. I can, if you connect up to my server with, with any of the smartphones, I can, when you leave the company, completely format your phone and set it up as if it's a brand new phone. I can also be a little bit nicer and just remove the packages of software that we put on your phone. I can just remove your email. And there are various levels. And then we get into other situations where in the past, people have had their phones nuked and they turned around and they sued their previous employer. See, they said you didn't have actually legitimate access to wiping it. And they said, yes, we did. No, you didn't. So it winds up in court. And the same thing with laptops. You bring your own laptop and you bring your own tablet in and you're utilizing it. How can they be sure, your employer, how can they be sure that you haven't put confidential company information onto whatever it is that you've brought in? So shadow IT is not bad. It's not good, but it's something we have to live with. It's something that we have to be aware of. It's something that can potentially wind up getting you into trouble with your employer. The best fix for this, if you want to bring in hardware, software, or a service, ask your IT department, ask your boss, ask the right people who can give the answers you want, but make sure they're also empowered to give those answers. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Ransomware victims aren't reporting attacks to police, and that's causing a big problem. Europol's annual cybercrime report says ransomware is underreported by victims, and some casualties appear to be simply hoping that nobody finds out that they were a target. Many victims of ransomware aren't reporting attacks to police, making it harder to measure the level of the crime and to tackle gangs involved. Europol's Internet Organized Crime Threat Assessment for 2020 report details that key forms of the cybercrime that pose a threat to the businesses right now, and ransomware remains one of the main concerns. especially as these gangs increasingly display high levels of skill and sophistication. In many cases, ransomware gangs don't just encrypt a network with malware and demand hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in Bitcoin. They also threaten to leak stolen, sensitive corporate file or personal data if they don't receive a payment. And while ransomware is one of the most high-profile forms of cyber attack, Europol's report warned that it remains an underreported crime as many organizations still aren't coming forward to law enforcement after falling victim. Several law enforcement agencies across Europe say they only heard of ransomware cases via reports in local media. The report suggests that approaching police to start a criminal investigation was not generally a priority for victims, who are more concerned with maintaining business continuity and limiting reputational damage. For some, the idea of getting law enforcement involved could be seen as a risk to their reputation. That's why some businesses are choosing to engage what Europol describes as private sector security firms to investigate attacks or negotiate ransom payments instead of approaching the authorities. Companies do this so evidence of the attack and their response to it can remain outside of the public eye, especially given how law enforcement and agencies recommend that organizations should never give in to demands of cyber criminals. But many businesses still view paying the ransom as the quickest and easiest way of restoring the operation, even if cyber criminal groups can't always be trusted to keep their word. And on top of the moral quandary when it comes to dealing with cyber criminals or private negotiators, police warn that not reporting ransomware attacks is detrimental to others. By using such companies, victims will not file an official complaint, which increases the lack of visibility and awareness concerning the real figures of ransomware attacks among law enforcement, says the Europol paper. Not reporting cases to law enforcement agencies will obviously hamper any efforts, as important evidence and intelligence from different cases can be missed. But it isn't just businesses that were actively attempting to avoid publicity that don't report ransomware attacks. The report notes that some victims just don't think that the law enforcement is able to do anything to help. However, the report adds that investigating every attack possible helps the authorities build up a better picture of the ransomware landscape and how to potentially prevent attacks or aid organizations that fall victim. For example, Europol's No More Ransom portal provides free decryption keys for various families of ransomware. The keys are provided by both cybersecurity companies and law enforcement agencies that have been able to break the encryption following investigation of the ransomware. If organizations don't report the ransomware attacks, it could prevent other victims from being able to use free tools like this. Intel claws back desktop PC and notebook market share from AMD. That's the first time in 3 years. It's now getting interesting. The Mercury Research CPU market share results are in for the fourth quarter of 2020. The headline news being that Intel has clawed back shares from AMD in the desktop PC market for the first time in 3 years. Intel also stopped its slide in notebook PCs, gaining share for the first time since they began collecting data for that segment in early 2018. AMD also lost shares in the overall x86 market during the quarter, but notched a solid gain for the year. Meanwhile, AMD continued to make slow but steady gain in the server market. It's noteworthy that the fourth quarter of 2020 was anything but typical. The PC market continued its pandemic-fueled surge, seeing its fastest growth in a decade. For example, while AMD lost share in the overall x86 market during the quarter, Mercury Research pegs the overall x86 market growth rate at an explosive 20.1%. Intel obviously captured more of that growth than AMD, but it's important to remember that a slight loss of share in the midst of an explosive growth environment does not equate to a declining sales. In fact, AMD grew its processor revenue by 50% last year and posted record financial results for the year. Shortages have plagued AMD due to ongoing supply chain issues. Given the lack of AMD products on shelves, The company is obviously selling all of the silicon it can produce, signaling strong demand. AMD expects to see tightness throughout the first half of 2021 until added production capacity comes online, meaning we could see a limited supply of AMD PCs and console chips until the middle of the year. These shortages led to a scarcity of AMD chips during the critical holiday shopping season in the fourth quarter, while Intel's chips were widely available and often selling at a discount. That obviously helped Intel recoup some share. During its recent earnings call, Intel also cited improving supply of lower-end processors, like those destined for Chromebooks, as a contributing factor, and Chromebook sales went through the roof last year. Intel has also expanded its chip production by leaps and bounds over the last several years as it recovered from its own shortage of production capacity. The company's tight control of its supply chain and production facilities have allowed it to be better weather disruptions. That's an important consideration as the company has come under intense criticism that it should spin off its fabrications while it weighs how much of its own production it should outsource. That said, given the dynamic nature of the market, it's hard to draw any firm conclusions. AMD recently announced its Ryzen 5000 processors that take the lead in every meaningful metric from Intel's Comet Lake chips, but a lack of supply could have hindered the company's gains in this fast-growing segment. Intel's Rocket Lake, which could present more competition for AMD's Ryzen 5000. While AMD lost some shares here during the quarter, it gained 1 percentage point for the year. However, AMD recently noted that its Ryzen 5000 chips doubled the launch sales of any other previous Ryzen generation, and annual processor revenue grew 50%, even though the PC market only grew 13%. It's logical to expect that AMD will prioritize the production of these higher-margin desktop processors to maximize its profitability. AMD has noted that its shortages are most acute in the lower end of the PC market, while Intel says it has improved its own shipment of small-core CPUs. In the mobile market share for the fourth quarter of 2020, this has been AMD's fastest-growing market. The mobile segment comprises roughly 60% of the client processor market, meaning any gains are very important in terms of overall volume and revenue. Intel has cited its increasing penetration into the lower end of the market like Chromebooks, which likely continue its strong gains here. Again, AMD has said that its shortages are most pressing in the lower end of the market. Notably, AMD remained in the black here for the year with a 2.8 percentage point gain. AMD recently launched its Ryzen 5000 mobile processors, which bring the powerful Zen 3 microarchitecture to laptops for the first time. AMD has 50% more designs coming to market than the previous generation of Ryzen 4000 lineup, but supply could be tight. AMD bases its server share projections on IDC's forecast, but only accounts for the single and dual socket market, which eliminates four-socket and beyond servers, networking infrastructure, and Xeon Ds. As such, Mercury's numbers differ from the numbers cited by AMD, which predict a higher market share. Here is AMD's comments on the matter. Mercury Research captures all x86 server class processors in its server unit estimate, regardless of device. That is to say, server, network, or storage. Whereas the estimated single-socket and two-socket total addressable market provided by IDC only includes traditional servers. AMD continues to chew away server share from Intel at a steady rate. These gains come on the cusp of the company's highly anticipated EPYC Milan launch in March. It's logical to expect that some customers may have paused purchases on current generation of EPYC ROM processors in anticipation of the looming Milan launch, and the resultant pent-up demand could increase AMD's server penetration next quarter. Also, given the importance of this lucrative segment, AMD will likely prioritize server chip production. The overall total market share for the last quarter of 2020 is that the overall x86 market grew at an explosive 20.1% rate during the quarter, and reflecting that a growing total addressable market benefits both players. AMD lost a minor amount of overall share during the quarter, but gained 6.2 percentage points for the year. Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, Coronavirus Self-Defense Class.
Self-defense, it's a term that implies another person, usually deliberately, is taking an action that might inevitably lead to your own pain and suffering. And so, you act to avoid that pain and suffering. And the notion of self-defense would even seem to extend beyond the pain and suffering brought about by fists or large weapons. What if the attack happens at a microscopic level? That question was answered long ago with the decision that germ warfare is nonetheless warfare. But in practical terms, if someone carrying a COVID-19 infection, for example, ignores the guidelines or regulations about masks and social distancing, don't reach for your broadsword. Your first response should be all about self-preservation. But what does that mean? Never leaving home without wearing some gigantic bubble? Also, how is coronavirus self-defense different from personal defense? Just like West Point and the Pentagon, knowing what's effective means knowing the enemy, not just the knuckleheads who are endangering you, but the virus itself. When Oak Ridge National Labs ran their months-long supercomputer analysis of the virus and its spread and the many factors that might boost or impede that, some incredibly significant results emerged. One is that almost all infections happen because of the virus getting into somebody's nose or mouth when they, now don't take this term trivially, when they breathe. Just plain inhaling. People inhale the virus, and inside the nose and mouth, yours too, mine, everybody's, there are specific points of contact that let a single virus manifest the infection. Breathing, a hard habit to break. Breathing is also where most of those viruses originate. Sometimes coughing, less often sneezing, but very often just exhaling. When an infected person exhales, the virus is riding out aboard the droplets normally in our breath, the same droplets that make our breath look like little white clouds in cold temperatures. Seen that lately? The virus aboard those droplets rides the wind of exhaled breath until they either fall to where they won't harm anyone, or they get inhaled by their next carrier. Tag, you're it. One more point. When people breathe through their mouths, those exhalation winds thrust straight out. When breathing through the nose with lips closed, those winds angle downward at about 45 degrees. The table is almost set with the things you need to know to determine your best self-defense approach when circumstances put you in the path of the pathogen. How much does wearing a mask make them any less infectious or you any safer? The answer is somewhat. Do you know the term attenuator or limiter? Those are technologies that can reduce the intensity of a too strong signal. That's also what a mask does. It reduces the forward air pressure when exhaling, the speed of the wind of outbound breathing, and with it, the distance that puff of virus-carrying droplets can travel before falling. At the same time, a mask will allow more droplet-carrying air out beside and behind the breather. That emerges more slowly, but it also explains why social distancing isn't just about the direction a nose is pointing. What about your mask? It also reduces forward air pressure, both positive pressure when you exhale and negative pressure when you inhale. So, to cut to the chase, wearing a mask means you will be inhaling mostly from the air that's closest to you and less from the air that's a little farther out there. Almost done describing the combat zone. How far is your nose off the floor? Typically, that's around 36 inches when you're in bed, 45 inches when you're in a chair, and 60 inches when you're standing. Most of the air you breathe comes from a zone that's about 2 feet tall with your nose in the middle, so from 12 inches above your nose to 12 inches below your nose. When the virus gets into that zone, you are in grave danger of infection. So, there you are, on the street or in the checkout line, and some self-centered idiot without a mask is getting closer. What are your options? If it's somebody who will keep moving and only be within, oh, say 20 feet of you for a short time, you might try holding your breath, literally. No inhaling at all until 15 seconds, give or take, after that idiot is more than 20 feet away from you again. If they keep moving, but not so briskly, put your hand over your mask and take very short breaths, all through your nose, holding your breath as long as possible between them. If that won't work, retreat, walk away. By the way, infected people can also reinfect themselves. Today, the total number of confirmed and presumed positive cases of the U.S. is at 27 million. More than 460,000 of those have died. 11.2 million are considered as recovered. That leaves more than 15 million who still have it. A good many of them are recuperating at home, in bed. And every time they exhale, there's live virus in their breath. So their very next breath inhales that live virus, reinfects them, adds to their body's virus loading, and helps that infection become more severe and last longer. Holding their breath would be hard, but deflecting their breath might be easy. A downward blowing fan, that's important. The blow must go downward. A ceiling fan or a fan on a stand or a clamp fan, a downward blowing fan can make that happen. It will divert the air. It will make it deflect away. It blows that exhaled breath away from where the next breath gets drawn and can help prevent self-reinfection, which can be important to the whole family. In October, the CDC reported on COVID-19 at-home infection rates, other people in the same house of infected people. More than half became infected, 53%, and most of those within 5 days. That held true whether the sick person was an adult or a child. That's enough for today's lesson, right? Until you get your vaccination completed, here are the takeaways from today's coronavirus self-defense class. 1. Masks, social distancing, and isolation can help. 2. Avoid inhaling, even if it means holding your breath. And 3. Downward-facing fans at a sick bed and between pairs of people. Next time, with the weather not yet getting better, we'll look at backing up the whole house with a generator, but as you'll learn, the technology is a very secondary factor in determining your best value. Be here for our report on generator power. You'll find it electrifying.
Thank you, Marty. Coming up March the 20th, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival. It is the original personal computer festival. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF, was created back in 1976 as an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, an exhibit area, as well as an outdoor flea market. But with the pandemic, all that got changed. TCF 2021 will be held as a virtual event on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. It will be a full day of learning and fun. TCF 21 is free via Zoom teleconferencing to all. Donations will be welcome and accepted to offset expenses. All you need is a personal computing device, like a personal computer, a tablet, and maybe perhaps a little difficulty, even a smartphone. The TCF keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, and he will be talking about How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. He is the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. This keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force, with an eye towards the significant positive impact on our world. For the festival, There are planned 10 simultaneous tracks during the course of the day, covering over 50 talks and workshops, special exhibits and demonstrations. Here are some highlights of some of the talks. Do-it-yourself home automation, tips and tricks for Windows 10, quantum computing, WordPress bootcamp, new Internet of Things using 5G, stock market trading using neural networks, hands-on Arduino workshop for beginners, get an amateur radio license in a day with ham, cram, and testing, and many others. There will also be meetup rooms to greet and meet friends from the past. The website for the festival is tcf-nj.org for more information. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 12th, via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is limac.org, that's limac.org, to get meeting ID information. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on speech recognition, Thursday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. The website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on current trends in personal technology, Thursday, February the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email address to hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.